You're listening to episode 32 of season 13 of the GNU World Order for day 216 of 2019. Hey everybody, before I forget, I've been asked by 5150 to mention that on August 9, 10, and 11, there is the Kansas Linux Fest located at the Wichita State University. I will unfortunately not be there. I'm kind of missing it by a day. Just coincidentally, I'm actually traveling out to the States August 10. I'll be in the States August 10, but I'll be way over on the East Coast, not very close to Kansas at all. And it's a pity. It's a pity because lately the only conferences that I really can get to are the larger ones, because that's the ones those are the ones that work will pay for, really. And so I'm missing out on great fests that were sort of my bread and butter when I lived in the States, and they were super easy to get to, such as the Southeast Linux Fest. Certainly I would have checked out the Kansas Linux Fest if that had been around when I was in the States, and so on. So it's a pity I'm not going to be there, but you should go if you're anywhere close to Kansas or get there. It's well worth attending, probably. I mean, I don't know, I've never been there, but these little, quote-unquote, little Linux Fests are kind of the places to go for the sheer amount of Linux content, as the name suggests. But in a way, they're the ones, I think, that you can rely upon sitting down to talk and actually seeing the speaker project a Linux desktop rather than some other desktop talking about generic open-source topics. So Linux Fest, Kansas Linux Fest, probably worth checking out August 9, 10, 11 at the Wichita State University. I would love to go. You should go in my stead. Let's see, aside from that, this episode, well, you know, previous episodes we've talked about kind of big topics, or not necessarily big topics, but we've gone quite far in depth into topics. So IPC, inter-process communication, was episode 31, and we talked about the password store in episode 30, hex dump in 29. So I kind of want to take a break from the super hardcore deep delves into commands and talk about a couple of different themes in this episode. One being how to set up a Dropbox-like function using Nextcloud. I think that's worth talking about because I had to do it recently for somebody, and it's not difficult to do, but it's one of those things where once you do it, you think, oh my gosh, that's really surprising that feature exists, and how nice. It's not a feature really that people seem to talk about a whole lot with Nextcloud. It's a lot of the buzz around Nextcloud is just the sheer convenience of having your own file system, I guess, available to you via a network, which is huge. And I've talked about that previously, I mean, years ago now, so it's probably worth mentioning again, but I won't right now. And then I also, if we have time, I'd like to talk about the conundrum of being a power user on Linux. And I'll explain what I mean by that in due time. First, let's start with Nextcloud. So Nextcloud, as you probably know, is a self-hosted cloud environment, which is kind of a nebulous term. The whole cloud term itself is pretty nebulous, and there are questions of, well, is it really a cloud, or is it a hybrid cloud, and who owns the cloud, and what's the cloud running on, what kind of infrastructure is running the cloud, and so on. So Nextcloud is sort of none of that. It's almost, if you think about it, it's almost sort of a CMS for your own stuff. That's kind of how I think about it. So if you imagine having, let's say, WordPress or Drupal or some sort of web app like that, except instead of exposing stuff to the wide world, it's really meant for users who are going to log in and sort of mess around in that environment. I think I've mentioned in the past that there were some really interesting experiments into the idea of a truly, truly remote desktop. I mean, where the desktop is not ever on your device. It exists on a server, and you log in and you interact with it. And there were some fascinating experiments around that a long time ago, and I'm pretty sure I had screenshots of it at a time, and I think those screenshots have just sort of faded from from hard drives because it's just not something that you ever think is that big of a deal at the time, or you think it's a big deal, but you think it's not gonna that it's a thing that's gonna be around forever, and so you don't think of it as something particularly special or historic. And then, of course, 10 years later, you look back and think, oh yeah, I should have probably kept track of those screenshots just for historical sort of proof of existences. I remember one was called iOS, EYEOS, and it was a little application on the on a server through the internet. You would log in, and there was a desktop, and the desktop was fully functional. It had, application menu. It had a task bar. It had a file manager window, and you would reach into your web browser and use this desktop environment just as you would your normal desktop, but it was in a web browser. So it was very much the feel of a, I guess, like a virtual machine, but it was unique because it ran in your web browser, and it was a fully functional environment. It was pretty slick, and I don't know that it's really around all that much now. If you go to opensourcecms.com/iOS, it seems like something pretty similar to it, released in 2005, with the latest release date being 2011. It does appear to sort of exist. I just don't know exactly how to get a hold of it or how to install it. There is a download link that goes to SourceForge. I don't know, I've kind of written off SourceForge at this point, so it's hard to take that seriously. That said, maybe, I don't know, maybe there's something to it. There is a iOS-2.5.rar available from 2013. Which doesn't align with the latest release, which said it was 2011. In other words, not too clear about what's going on with that. Maybe I'll check it out and report back on it later. I don't know. Point being, there were these attempts to provide remote operating environments at one point, and they went as far as they went. There were a lot more than iOS. That was just the one that I could remember off the top of my head. And I think ultimately people probably figured out that taking the desktop paradigm and sticking it into a web browser just didn't really make a whole lot of sense. It was one of those interesting experiments that ultimately it was just like, well, we probably don't need this full desktop experience necessarily, especially for if you're assuming we're going to run it in a web browser, then the web browser itself is probably running in a desktop environment. So you've got this weird level of recursion that you probably just flat out don't need. And it probably there's a barrier there, right? You can't take something out of your iOS file manager and drag it into your native desktop file manager. So suddenly there it feels like there's a blocker, like there's a like it's it the convenience factor goes way down because you see something that you feel should be possible, but you can't do it. And so what sort of evolved from that, I think, were things like Nextcloud, and probably there are closed source equivalents to this, which I don't actually know what those would be. Maybe SharePoint. I don't know. Is that like this at all? I'm not really sure. But it's a shared file system, right? I mean, that's ultimately all you really need is just an access to these shared directories and shared files, and that's what Nextcloud basically is. And then on top of that convenience of having access to these files that you want to have access to, you've also got apps that can run inside your environment. And these apps amount to sort of services that you might expect from a home page on the internet. So you might have like a RSS feed reader, you may have a calendar app, or a chat app so you can talk to other people in your little Nextcloud bubble, and so on. So you've got these add-on features to what ultimately is a file manager, and the file manager has basic file management features that you copy a directory, you can rename a directory, you can upload files into directories, and so on. And then you can share the directories, right? So if you've got two people in your little Nextcloud bubble that you've installed on your server, you create two logins. Now you've got Klaatu and you've got Gort, and they can both log into the cloud. And if they want to send each other information, they can put that information into a directory, click the little share icon, add the other person to the sharing permission set, and now the other person finds that directory in their little cloud environment. It's been shared with them, so they have a window into it. And of course, there's different levels of sharing. You can share so that they can read the stuff that you provide them. You can share it such that they can read and edit, and so on. So it's a lot like a multi-user system. It is kind of the Unix ideal happening in this kind of very friendly, shareable environment. Now, I've used Google Drive a little bit in real, not in real life, but in work life. And I have to say that Nextcloud is a heck of a lot more, it takes a much more logical approach to the process. Nextcloud, I've never felt like I don't have, like I can't keep track of stuff in Nextcloud the way that I felt about Google Drive. For instance, I know that on, at least from what I can tell on Google Drive, you don't really have an idea of sort of the location of a directory. And generally the URLs that I've seen when people send me stuff on a Google Drive, that they tend to be something like drive.google.com and then slash and then some huge, long, some SHA-256 hash string that makes no sense. And apparently you can't create shortcuts to these things. I mean, like you cannot impose like a realistic name on them. But in Nextcloud, you've got something like example.com/nextcloud, let's say, it's where you've got your cloud installed, /index.php/apps/files/?=foo. And that would be the path to the directory called foo. Sure, it's a little bit clunky. There's a lot of index.php/apps/files/?. That could be cleaned up maybe. And maybe there's a function in Nextcloud to clean that up. I don't know. I've never looked into it because it hasn't been a problem for me. But certainly that's a heck of a lot easier. You know, if you know that the front part of your path is all that, and then it ends in *dir=, and then the name of the directory, then that's really all you need to know to go straight to the place that you want, which is really, really refreshing to me because, you know, it feels like a lot of the, shall we say, larger tech companies that are really trying to push kind of their own infrastructure on people, for whatever reason, it just seems like they're really dedicated, like seriously dedicated, like legitimately, they have an interest in obfuscating how to get to your own data. And I don't know exactly what that's all about. I don't know if it's a true oversight, and they think, and it just never occurred to them that any user might ever want to know exactly how to point to a location, or if it's something a lot more nefarious than that, where they just think, well, the less that we give to people, the more that they will be sort of in service to us, because they'll have to use our infrastructure to find their own data, and won't that be fun for them? And they do seem to be pushing like the whole search idea a lot, right? Like a couple of different companies have said either blatantly or just implicitly that they have decided that the way people organize things is by putting them into a big bucket and then searching. You can do that in Nextcloud if that's the way that you prefer to do things, but certainly if you don't prefer to do that, you don't have to. There are ways to find your own data. You can jot down on a piece of paper, a physical piece of paper, file paths, you know, and you just know that, okay, everything starts with this big, long, ugly string, possibly, and then it terminates with the *dir=, and then the name of that directory that you want. And I think that's a brilliant method and a lot more user-friendly to me. And Nextcloud's super easy to install, too, and I think I've probably said this on the show before, but it really is embarrassingly easy. You can run this thing on a shared hosting, like a virtual private shared host. You can run Nextcloud, probably. I mean, it helps if you have SSH access, helps if you can get in there and adjust, you know, which PHP version you're running, and so on, but generally, places seem to be pretty open to that now, at least so as far as I can tell. I haven't had a problem. I'm running it on two virtual private, no, one now, but I have run it on two separate ones, three separate ones, and there's never been a problem. It sort of boils down to, I think, this is the way that I think about it. If you can run WordPress on your virtual private hosting, then you can run Nextcloud. That's the general rule of thumb that I've been going off of. There are obviously exceptions, like if you get the dirt cheapest, I don't know, GoDaddy account or something, where technically you can run WordPress because GoDaddy has a magic button that they press for you, then yeah, maybe you can't do Nextcloud so well. But if you can install WordPress, then you can install Nextcloud. And generally speaking, it's just a matter of setting your PHP version, maybe giving your PHP a little bit more memory in php.ini, and then just dropping Nextcloud in, going to the setup page in your browser and letting it run its thing. It can use an SQLite database, it can use a MySQL database, it's up to you, and you're off and running. So, and of course I should mention, I mean, if you don't want to do that, if that's not your style, if you prefer to have someone else run your infrastructure, which is perfectly acceptable, you can go to nextcloud.com and purchase hosting, like a hosting plan from them, and they'll be a dedicated Nextcloud host for you to use your Nextcloud on. Now you could argue, well, that defeats the purpose of Nextcloud because now you're using someone else's infrastructure. But I feel like that's not correct. I feel like Nextcloud hosting your infrastructure isn't such a horrible thing because it's Nextcloud is super good about being able to get your data back out. And I think that's where a lot of the bigger tech companies obviously sort of transgress the most, is that once you give them your data, it's not necessarily super easy to get your stuff back out. But Nextcloud is 100% about making sure that you retain all of your data, access to all of your data at all times. So it's quite nice. And, you know, I don't know, there's HTTPS, so if you're concerned about privacy, there's that. Whether or not you really want to store your stuff on someone else's server is up to you. But certainly I guess what I'm saying is I would rather pay Nextcloud to host my own quote-unquote personal cloud, although it's on their infrastructure, so personal is a little bit fuzzy. But I'd rather do that than, for instance, give everything over to Google, for instance, or even Apple, frankly. I mean, like, I think Apple still has their iCloud or their Mi or whatever they call it these days. You know, and it's great that they're being very, very, very good about encryption, apparently, people tell me. But I'm just not sure if I would give all that stuff over to them necessarily. I think I would probably, well, I know I wouldn't because I don't, but I would rather have it on my own little Nextcloud slice. So all that's just to say that if you don't have a Nextcloud install yet, you should get one. It's really cool. I mean, I lived and breathed off of Nextcloud at my old job at a movie studio, where there was a lot of stuff locked down for fear of things being leaked, you know, screenshots of upcoming movies and stuff being leaked out. There was a, sort of a pretty good restriction on access outside of any kind of network. And it was just really nice to have Nextcloud that I could log in just to, instead of, you know, a lot of people used Google to log in to get stuff, you know, to get access to their calendar or to get access to files that they needed to refer to during the day, as you do at work, right? You have to pay an electric bill or something and you need a copy of it or something. So Nextcloud, you've got it, you've got all your stuff, but it's not through Google. So I yeah, it was something that I used, just it was my daily driver in many ways at my old job, and even now it's been great for me for a couple of different projects. I've got a couple of different installs with different people on different projects having access, and it's fantastic. It's a great way to keep files in sync without having to deal with, you know, Git stuff, which, I mean, Git is great, but it's not necessarily the best for, I don't know, spreadsheets or something. So having Nextcloud as that shared environment is really, really, really cool. And there are lots of little apps, like I say, like there are lots of things that you could use within Nextcloud to, you know, the text editors and things like that that you can get so that you really can kind of live in the web browser, which typically I don't like to do, but if that's the option that you have in a certain environment, then that's maybe the best environment or the best option. Okay, so my point anyway is that in addition to everything else that this thing does, it could also create a Dropbox-like functionality. Now, it natively is sort of at least part of a Dropbox functionality, which, when I say that, I mean it is a system by which you can have stuff living on a server somewhere, staying in sync to some folder, some arbitrary folder in your home directory. And I've heard a lot of people who say that's what they want in life. Like, that's what they want. And I know that there's a thing called sync thing, I think. At least it used to be. There used to be a thing called sync thing. Yeah, sync thing. And I don't remember if I'm kind of looking at it right now because I don't remember if it's, yeah, it is. It's Mozilla public license, apparently. It's an odd choice, it seems, but there you go. So sync thing, continuous file synchronization between systems, and it's got a whole bunch of different clients, and it works on all different kinds of operating systems and phones and so on. It is open source, it is open protocol, so that's something to look at, I guess. But, and I'm sure there are lots of great features about sync thing. It's never something that I've ever needed, so I've never actually looked into it. I've heard other people talk about it a lot. But for me, at least, it tends to not be, like, my whole home directory that I want synchronized. As I've said on the show before, I've got my little thumb drive, a magical thumb drive that has all of my data on it, and I back that up to my computer when it's attached, and that's just kind of the system that I use. I could see myself using sort of a remote syncing thing, whether it's a sync thing or Nextcloud in the future at some point, but certainly not right now. It's something that I'll probably consider. It does seem quite appealing on some level, but I think I would want to run that off of my home server rather than any kind of purchased server. So anyway, point being, Nextcloud can do that. I use Nextcloud. There's a desktop client that looks at one specific folder or several specific folders. So right there, if you're using Dropbox for that functionality, Nextcloud already is superior in that sense, because I believe Dropbox doesn't necessarily let you have more than one account. I think there are minor little hacks that you can do to sync two folders at the same time or something like that via Dropbox, but it's definitely a hack. It's not something that you're meant to do. Nextcloud doesn't care, obviously, how many accounts you have with Nextcloud. You're running them, so you can do whatever you want. The desktop clients let you dial in whatever account you want, point it at whatever folder you want it to be pointed at, and that becomes your synchronized folder. And in any sort of Linux desktop environment, and probably others, but certainly in KDE or GNOME, it handles that quite nicely. It lets you know when things have been synchronized and what's fallen out of sync and so on. So you have a really good idea of the progress of, okay, well, is this file actually on my server? Oh, yes, it is. It's just been synchronized. So that's good. And so that's right there. For a lot of people, that is the Dropbox angle, right? That's what they use Dropbox for. It's kind of what they expect out of if you say it's like a Dropbox, then that's what they're looking for. But there is that other side of Dropbox, which I think probably is possibly at some point was probably what Dropbox was intended to be, maybe, I don't know. And that is where people can upload files to a server for you, or download files from a server that you want them to have. And you can set that up in Nextcloud by creating a new folder and maybe calling it something like, I don't know, drop or dropper or data drop. Let's call it data drop. That's cool. Data drop. And once the folder exists, which now it does, you can click on it and then click the little share icon, and that brings up a side panel. And the main option when sharing is to obtain a share link. And whenever you obtain a share link, you can make that shared link read-only. You can allow uploading and editing. You can create a file drop for uploading only, so people can put things in but never see anything that was put in. You can allow downloads. You can password protect it. You can set an expiration date and provide a note to the recipient so that they know, you know, why they're at your page, why they've been told to upload something. Or, of course, you can delete a shared link. And you can create several shared links. So if you need some set of people to have upload access and another set of people to have upload and editing, maybe with a password protection before they can edit, then you could create a different share link for them. So you've got different means by which you can allow people to interact with your shared link. Now, I will say that the shared links aren't super pretty. They're very much sort of what I was complaining about with the Google Drive stuff. It's example.com/nextcloud or whatever, /index.php, and then /s/qrsla6z2b, it just goes on and on. Not super pretty. Now, luckily, if you're running your own Nextcloud, I think that it's quite trivial. It would be quite trivial, I would think, to then create a simple shortened link to your file share. The way that I do this is I go into a server and I create a new directory. So let's say it's example.com/, I guess data drop would make sense since that's what we're calling our little Dropbox space. So I would do a make directory data drop, and then in that folder, create an index.html, and this will be really simple. You just put a head tag, and then title, data drop, close title, and then meta http/equiv equals quote refresh close quote content equals quote 0 url equals and then dot dot. So go back one directory /nextcloud/index.php/s/6 or qrsla6z, whatever I said it was, close quote, close tag, close head. Now you've got a URL, an HTTP redirect in the default file of the folder example.com/datadrop. So whenever anyone goes there to example.com/datadrop, they get dumped into the index.html by default, which by default forwards them to the actual location of your data drop. So it's basically like making your own shortened URLs, like your bit.ly and your whatever else there is out there. But it's just kind of the very manual way of doing that, I guess. But the point is that if people need to send you big files or they want to send you a file, you don't have to go set up a FTP server or somewhere, an account somewhere, an SFTP, ideally. You don't have to go through all that. Nextcloud is the super easy, friendly way to do that. You create your little shared link to any given directory on your Nextcloud, in your Nextcloud file system. You give them either that shared link directly or you create a shortened version of that link for them to go to. And they get taken to a very friendly, sort of familiar looking web page, right? It's just it's a nice, pretty HTML page. And this will work on a mobile or a desktop. It's just a web page. There's a big button that says upload files, and they click it, and then they can upload files to you, and that's all they need to do. People have been doing this. I've got one set up for a certain project that I'm involved with, and people use it all the time from all over the world. They get pictures get uploaded, processed, and posted, and it's just that simple. I mean, it's not super robust because it's all just sort of a manual process. It's not my gig though, so I don't care. If I was doing this, I would probably have the uploads happen and then some script would drop in and do the processing with Image Magic or something like that and post them. But it's not my thing. I'm just managing infrastructure, so it doesn't matter to me. But it is super friendly. People enjoy it. People aren't afraid to go there, click on the button, and it works. I think it's time for coffee, so let's go get one. And we're back. Hopefully you've got a cup of coffee. I've got my cup of coffee. You know, I was thinking the other day how I was protecting the identity of the person who had sent me coffee, and I realized that it's actually not that important, because if you want your name mentioned on the show, you can just email me and say, hey, mention my name on the show. It would be that easy. So it was Carl. Carl sent me the coffee. There, now everybody knows. It's out. It's no longer a secret. Thank you, Carl, for sending me coffee. Next up, we're going to talk about the conundrum of being a power user on Linux. What does that mean? It kind of occurred to me the other day, because I was talking to someone, a friend of mine, and he was he was he, I've actually this has happened a couple of times, so there's two separate people that I'm thinking of actually, and in both cases they were talking, and it was sort of they would qualify something with "I'm not a technical user," and they would say that frequently, "I'm not a technical user." Now, you know how I feel about that term, right? Technical user. What does that even mean? Like, why isn't everyone a technical user? Why are there technical users and non-technical users? I don't really get that. But they would say that. They would qualify anything that they were doing on the computer with, "Well, I'm not a very technical user." And it's funny because then, you know, the next sentence is, "And so I opened up the terminal and blah blah blah," you know, and performed some task in a way that many people would think, well, that's a very technical activity that you've just done. And both of these people that I'm talking about are running Linux desktops. And so right there, a lot of people would say, well, then you're a technical user, because only technical users can possibly use Linux, and so on. So there's a lot of, you know, this caveat of, "Oh, I'm not a very technical user." It's this weird kind of, it's this qualifier for something that I think, because you're almost afraid that because you are using this specific tool, people will interpret you to be more knowledgeable than perhaps you actually are. Or maybe because you're afraid that people will expect you to then lean into the technicalities of things more than you care to lean into them. You don't really want to necessarily get that far into it. And I think that's a totally fair thing. I don't think that people should have to be more into any one aspect of a computer than they want it to be. There's no reason for that. I think it's important that people are able to specialize in whatever they darn well please, right? If you want to be the expert on color spaces or composite modes in GIMP, then that's what you should be able to do. You should be able to concentrate on that one thing, and that can be your thing. And if someone says, "Cool, well, you obviously know a lot about composite modes, so why don't you just drum up a quick C application to create this effect?" And you should be able to comfortably say, "Because I don't know C, and I don't want to learn C. I'm a user. I do this thing, and that's what I do, and that's my specialty." That's an important policy to establish. I think Linux desktops should not imply that anyone using the thing is necessarily. I should mention, I'm looking out the window right now, and it is just snowing like you wouldn't believe. It has been snowing all morning, all day, and it is fantastic. It's 4 inches of snow on the ground right now. It's really, really amazing. The South Island is so much better than the North Island of New Zealand. Anyway, the Linux desktop shouldn't demand that people become more technical than they want to become. And I think sort of almost in a weird way, the flip side of that is when you are using Linux and you accidentally become a power user. You become that sort of very technical user who you get curiouser and curiouser, and you keep going farther and farther down that path of, well, now that I understand how this composite mode works, or what results visually it produces, I'd really like to actually see the code for that. And so you go and open up the source code of that mode, and you look at it to figure out why it's doing that thing, or why it's not taking this into account, or something like that. And suddenly you're going really, really deep into some aspect of something that previously you couldn't have done anyway. Because if you're doing this on, if you're looking at Adobe Photoshop composite modes, you are literally unable to analyze those, right? You can look at what visually they produce. You can come up with theories on why some reaction occurs or doesn't occur, but you can't go look at the source code for confirmation. That's not something that you can do. It would be highly illegal for you to do that, in fact, if you were able to obtain that code. So the fact that you have like the luxury of doing that on Linux and on open source in general is huge. It's a huge big deal, and it's a very sort of enabling thing. You know, if you have that question, that inkling of a question, then watch out, because you could fall off the edge and actually find out. Now, the conundrum here is that if you do that, if you sort of take advantage of all of these luxuries that open source affords you, you become, whether you sort of think about it or not, whether you sort of own up to it or not, you become a power user. You become a highly technical user because you had a question about how this composite mode works or about how to customize your file manager in this way or how to customize your text editor in that way. And you go look, you go find out. And now you're that much, you've accidentally taken a step up this imaginary ladder and people sort of observing you might casually say, well, you are quite the power user now, aren't you? Because you've customized this aspect of your computer. But that wasn't your intent. You didn't do that thing because you thought to yourself, I want to become a power user. You just did it because you were able to. And so the more you do that, the more you take advantage of open source, the more technical, the more of a power user you become, thereby more or less negating your statement, your disclaimer that you're not a power user, you're not a technical user. And I'm not 100% sure what that statement even means. If you say I'm not a technical user, or I'm not a power user, I think what we're really saying when we say this as desktop Linux desktop users who say that, I think what we're all really saying is don't mistake me for someone who was trained to do this, or who set out with the purpose of getting to where I am. I sort of wandered in by accident to this point. And that's really what we're saying, is that it was not fully intentional to get this deep into the wires and twiddly knobs as it is for people who have gone to school and said, okay, I'm going to become a programmer and I'm going to, or a UX designer or a whatever, where they're there and they have all the right industry terms and they know the things to cite and the sources to look at and all of that other stuff. We're just sort of accidental power users. And the frustrating thing about that, I think, is that once you've become an accidental power user, then it's very, very difficult to convince people looking on that you're not that there's no glass separating you. You know, that when they're observing you and thinking, well, that person can only do this thing because they're highly technical. But you think, well, no, I'm not highly technical. I wandered in here and happened to wander a little bit farther than I realized I was wandering. So you know, anyone could be here. Like, there's no special, I didn't get a special grant to be here. I didn't get some kind of, I didn't steal anything to get here. It's just persistence and sort of out of sheer ignorance that I ended up knowing everything that there is to know, as far as I can tell, about this one aspect of the thing. You know, whether it's, I don't know, to keep going back to my GIMP composite mode expertise or KDN Live composite blending mode expertise or how to configure your text editor in a certain way or what options you need to enter into your Nginx configuration to do a reverse proxy in such a way that, you know, whatever, load balancing, whatever it might be, you gain this expertise and somehow in this weird way you necessarily give up that card of, I'm not a very technical user, I'm just a normal person. You become this sort of elevated, super smart person, even though really there's no reason to think that you are any different than someone looking on. And that can be frustrating because you think it can become an excuse for some people not to go in that direction. You know, sort of like, well, I can't do that thing. You're there because you're very professional, you're very much a power user and a technical user. I couldn't be there, so I'm going to stay right here. And you think, but I was you like 3 years ago. Like, but I was right where you were. And it's just this idea that there's like a separation between the people who have figured this thing out and who haven't figured it out. And there's no barrier, actually. And it's very difficult sometimes to convince people that barrier just isn't there. Now, there's the other side of that story is that there are barriers between where you are and where you were sometimes for some people. There can be barriers that that didn't happen to exist for you, whether it's this person has three jobs and doesn't have time to investigate all the little niggly bits that you were able to investigate because you only had two jobs and you didn't have anything better to do in the evening, so you ended up becoming an expert on this thing. You know, so I mean, there is that. But in terms of just kind of whether or not there is an inherently technical user, I can't see that that's a thing. And I feel like there's, I feel like the tech industry, some parts of the tech industry want that to be a reality, that there is a difference between the non-programmer and the programmer. And then other parts of the tech industry really doesn't want there to be that difference. You know, you've got the programming for everyone and you know, all these specialist groups of like, hey, everyone should learn JavaScript or everyone should learn Python or whatever. And I think that in spirit is great. But then there is that persistent sort of, I feel like it's the marketing machine where there has to be these extremely quote-unquote user-friendly interfaces so that people can log in and do these simple tasks in these safe environments provided by these big technical corporations that wouldn't want to expose anyone to anything that was too scary or too technical for them. And so there are these very easy ways to get certain things done. And I think right now, one of the barriers to breaking down the separation between those things, honestly, is that so much has moved to the internet that to get people to sort of establish places where normal people can go and do normal things, you really do kind of need an infrastructure. And I think that's one of the biggest dangers to universal computing right now is the reliance upon infrastructure. If you want to run a website where you have lots of people going to it and participating in, I don't know, social network activity, whatever that may be, then you kind of need a thing that runs reliably so that it's so that it's there when people need it. Because I mean, it's one thing to say, oh, we can just throw up a quick Nextcloud instance and we'll basically have a Facebook-like function. I don't really know what Facebook does, so I don't know. But, you know, you have a place to come and share pictures with each other and do whatever else you might do on a social media thing. But if that Nextcloud instance falls out of updates or something goes wrong with your database or you've installed it on a little VPS slice and you realize that you've got too many people for that now and you're going to need dedicated hosting, you know, and it becomes this sort of this problem where you suddenly need like these, you need the infrastructure and you don't necessarily have it, or if you did have it, then it's going to start costing you more to run. There's a huge, you know, it kind of becomes a different, this whole becomes like a problem of just logistics. Whereas the big corporations out there running these entities that people go to every day, they don't have that problem. They just have a big pool of bandwidth and storage, and they do whatever needs to be done. And it sort of happens magically out there. And that's quite a convenient sort of luxury to have and not something that everyone does have. And I think that things like Mastodon and I think, what is it, Pixel Feed, Pixel Tube, something like that. There are a couple of quote-unquote federated technologies out there now that are seeking to sort of start to break that down. But as someone on Mastodon said months ago now, is that for it to really truly work the way that it needs to work, it needs to be an app, right? Everything's got to be an app. Not a mobile app, but it needs to be something that you download and you have this clickable entity and you click on it and it launches and maybe you've got a window where you configure a couple of things and that's the extent of it. And now you've got your own node on a much larger network and your node can pull in things from other places such that there is the illusion that you're all on the same, well, it's not an illusion, but there's that you are now on the same network, but you're only on the same network by virtue of the fact that you've joined as a node. And now we've got an infrastructure that creates itself. And I think that's really, really a place where we kind of need to get to eventually. Probably sooner than later would be good. And I think it's important for that to exist because the the idea of federation rather than, well, of decentralization rather than centralization. That's the important aspect of getting free of the infrastructure requirements. I think that'll help. I think that'll help differentiate between self-provided solutions versus tech company solutions. And ideally, in that kind of situation, you've got people who are not necessarily quote-unquote technical users, but they end up wandering into a technical domain because now they're doing things like running their own nodes on a larger network. And it doesn't feel like a technical thing that they're doing, but you could argue it's a very technical thing. I think for a lot of people, that's the difference between the, I'm not a technical user, but I am a technical user, is how technical, quote-unquote technical, does it feel? If it feels very technical, like if you had to open up a terminal and look at source code to figure out this composite node or whatever you're doing, then you're a technical user. But if it was super easy and all you had to do was click a button, then you're not a technical user, but you've done this really technical, cool thing. A great example, I guess another really good example, would be the LAMP stack, which I've talked about on this episode and I've written some blog posts about before. You should probably revisit that. But there are a couple of different projects out there. I think one is called XAMPP, I think. And the idea is that for a web developer who knows HTML and CSS and maybe, you know, the bare basics of web development, but they know nothing about sysadmin sort of infrastructural types of things, there was this application, I think it was called XAMPP. I could be mixing that up, that's something else, but there was this application where you download the application, you double click, and it would launch it, and it would say, okay, you're running a web server now. You know, and that was it, that you were running a local web server, so that your PHP and your JavaScript and stuff would work as expected. And I always used to look at that and just think, why would anyone use that if they're on Linux? Like, it would be so much easier to just download Apache and start it, and you're done. Like, you've got a LAMP stack now, because the L part of that LAMP stack was always there anyway, and all you're doing is filling in the little extra bits. But there was this application, a dedicated application that you could download and click, and it would do the same thing for you, but it felt so much easier because it was this application with an icon that you could double click. Highly technical activity disguised as something, I guess, for lack of a better term, user-friendly. So that's something to think about, I guess, is the presentation of technical tasks. How do they come across to people? What are the user's expectations, and what can we provide to enable them to do secretly? What are secretly highly technical functions? That's about all I've got for this episode. Remember, next week I will be in the U.S. So if you are in the U.S. on the East Coast, specifically in Raleigh, North Carolina, let me know. Otherwise, I'll be there again in October, so for the All Things Open conference. So either way, let me know if you're around. Coffee is not out of the question in that event. And I'll be in San Diego as well, not next week, but the week after. So either of those two locations, Raleigh, North Carolina, San Diego, California, San Diego for the Open Source Summit. That should be an exciting big conference. I'll be talking about Lua there. So if you're there, look me up at the Game Developer Miniconf. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next time. Podcast. This has been Klaatu. You can reach me on IRC. I'm on the Freenode network, usually in channels such as Augcast Planet, Slacker Media, Slackware, a couple of others. My nick on IRC is not Klaatu. You can also reach me lately on Mastodon. My username there is @Klaatu at mastodon.xyz. Of course, you can email me at klaatu@member.fsf.org. That's klaatu@member.fsf, as in Free Software Foundation.org. And of course you can visit my various websites, GNUWorldOrder.info and SlackerMedia.info. I will see you next time.
The subconscious will listen and expand this message.